Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on May 4th, 2019. This is the 16th week of our Saturday 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Karma Sutta. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Today's talk is on the Karma Sutta, but any authentic teaching on karma is also a teaching on the Buddha's meaning of rebirth. I started this talk Tuesday the same way, so it worked pretty well. I don't know, how many of you know who Jiddu Krishnamurti was? I can't say is, because he passed a while ago, just you. Jiddu Krishnamurti was one of the... Good morning, Mary! Was one of the modern world's greatest thinkers. I think he passed about 30. Do you remember when he, I think about 30 years ago, is that right? Just a remarkable man. If you ever come across any of his books, one of them that I always comes to mind is a book called Think on These Things. And so I would say that he had a grasp of the three marks of existence. What separated Krishnamurti from Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, was that he didn't understand the need for an eightfold path. In other words, he taught mostly in abstract concepts about how we should think, what reality looks like, but he did not understand that profound understanding that the Buddha had, that the... Somebody just came in on me.
Sound like it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that was wrong.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
that because of the nature of ignorance, right, the Buddha awoke and he awoke to dependent origination. It states, from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of suffering arises. That's the thing that Krishnamurti lacked, was that we needed some path to recognize and abandon that very specific ignorance. So without putting Krishnamurti down, because I think he was a brilliant man, which leads to the reason why I said all that. He used to say in the beginning of almost every talk that he ever gave, and you can find him on the internet, look at the life you're living, which is a teaching on karma. What he's saying is not just a cursory look, but to look at it from the right frame of reference, and that's where the Buddha's Eightfold Path comes in. Another way of describing karma is that if you want to know what you want, look at what you have. Karma is what you want. No matter how much you might want to say that's not true, I don't want stress and suffering and confusion and conflict in my own mind, but that's what you have, most people. At least it comes and goes, doesn't it? And there's no way to overcome anything that you yourself have produced within yourself unless you change it within yourself. So karma, another way of explaining the abstract karma as a practical experience, karma is the experience of anatta, wrong views of self. And to take that just a little bit further, karma is the experience of a misunderstanding of the three marks of existence, of the impermanence of all things, the not self-characteristic, meaning a misunderstanding of what actually constitutes a self, and the resulting suffering. That's all part of karma, the abstract word karma. Another way to describe the personal experience of karma that the Buddha used is five clinging aggregates. That's the practical experience of the abstract karma. Is everybody following me?
Mm-hmm.
So the reason why I'm emphasizing that and emphasizing the fact that karma is simply an abstract description of something is that there's nothing be motivating karma save our own ignorance. Karma is often taught today, especially in pop culture, forget even Buddhism, that karma is a grand spiritual system of behavior modification through reward and punishment. If you did something bad yesterday, you're going to suffer for it today. If you did something good, maybe if you're lucky, some point in the future, you'll get rewarded. It's got nothing to do with karma. What's more, what the motivating part of karma is intention, or what we're holding in mind. So I think the best description of karma, even though it's a little bit conceptual, is karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional acts, that's important, moderated by the present level of mindfulness, meaning what we hold in mind will either continue ignorance, if what we're holding in mind is fabricated views, or, and that's a teaching on rebirth, if what we're holding in mind are views rooted in ignorance, excuse me, then in this moment, I can only hope to give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. Make sense? Yes, no?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If what I'm holding in mind is framed by the Eightfold Path, then what I will give birth to in this moment is a moment that is inclined towards awakening. And so this, when you look at karma and rebirth in that way, it is an entire Dhamma teaching because it's pointing us to where to practice wise restraint, which is in this moment. It doesn't do us any good, or not much good, to realize that yesterday or 30 years ago I did something that I regret now, or that if I don't do this I might not get what I want next week or in a future lifetime, because look where your head is. It's either in the past or the future. It's not present. It can't, and a mind that's not present can't address its karma, because karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional acts, moderated by what I hold in mind. So that's a little bit clearer, I think. Yes, please say yes.
Because
I can't. I can't really see if you're saying nodding your head. And how many of you read the introduction to this, to the Karma Sutta? Okay. I was going to read it again anyway, probably, because the Buddha's teachings on karma, there's a fair number of suttas that he mentions karma, but they're always very brief and direct teachings because there's not a lot to know about karma, despite what's developed. From the introduction, many modern Buddhist teachers who misunderstand, misapply, or outright dismiss dependent origination and Four Noble Truths do so to dismiss or rationalize and validate confused and misleading views on karma and rebirth. Karma is often portrayed by modern Buddhists. In fact, there's a couple of very famous modern Buddhist teachers who are really altering. In fact, one is saying that the Four Noble Truths have, they're reinterpreting in a way that has nothing at all to do with Four Noble Truths. And that's unfortunate. But they're doing it because for many years they've been saying, don't even consider karma and rebirth because they're anachronisms. They're not important teachings. The Buddha only taught these teachings to be relevant to his time. That is a complete misunderstanding. Karma is the central theme of the Buddha's Dhamma. The resulting dharmas from that type of thinking are likewise confused and misleading. Karma, or the Pali term kama, K-A-M-M-A, I don't use that. I usually use Pali terms, but I've noticed confusion in people. I can just see it in their face when I say kama, and they're wondering, are you saying that? Karma. Karma was a common word during the Buddha's time. The common belief in karma is rooted in the Vedas and the Upanishads that Siddhartha Gautama studied prior to his awakening. The Vedas and the Upanishads are the scriptural foundation for modern Hinduism. The Buddha rejected these teachings as they did not lead to his goal of understanding the true nature of human life within an ever-changing environment. So there's a lot of reference to the Buddha as a master yogi, etc. Yogi, or the yogi-based philosophy, is something the Buddha recognized and dismissed. Not that it wasn't valuable in some way, he never said that, he just said it doesn't lead to the goal, it's a distraction. Many modern Buddhists claim that the Buddha only mentioned karma and rebirth because it was a common teaching of his time, and he only did so to be relevant. This is simply another fabricated strategy used by many to continue to ignore ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha used many common words, such as kama or karma, anicca, anatta, dukkha, and many others, in new and unique applications. In fact, every one of those words was a common word that the Buddha used in a completely different way to make the point that what he's teaching is something completely different than what most people are holding in mind and see the world and their relationship to the world. The Buddha taught that to clearly teach the contrast between his Dhamma and common magical and mystical beliefs of his time. This common misunderstanding of karma and rebirth continues to today. Rather than teach karma and rebirth as irrelevant anachronisms or magical and mystical spiritual attainments, the Buddha taught that recognizing the cause and developing the cessation of karma as the central theme of his Dhamma. Karma is not to be seen as a magical system of reward and punishment, hoping for spiritual behavior modification based on gaining notice and favor from disincarnate beings. Karma is not the result of a lack of worship or improper or inadequate chanting or any other rite or ritual. In other words, we can't engage in fabricated practices and hope that that's going to address the problem of fabricated views. Karma is the direct result of self-supported ignorance of Four Noble Truths. I want to read it again. Karma is the direct result of self-supported ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So if we're going to bring our karma to cessation, what do we need to do?
Tied to the Eightfold Path.
Practice the Eightfold Path.
Why? Karma is a direct result of self-supported. Yes. Yes. It's the whole point. The whole point of karma, the Buddha's Dhamma, everything. Everything the Buddha taught was taught for that paragraph.
Empty yourself of ignorance.
Empty yourself of ignorance. Thank you. Karma is the abstract word the Buddha used to describe the practical experience of five clinging aggregates within an impermanent environment, the three marks of existence. Karma is what we want. The five clinging aggregates are what we want. We've taken these aggregates, we've clung them together and say, this is me. And when we react to form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, or consciousness rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, when we react to that, because we create an identity over that, we are increasing our karma. Mm-hmm. When we recognize it as it arises, it's the only way or place or instance that we can practice a Dhamma, as it's arising, as ignorance is manifesting through this karmic experience, it's at that point of arising phenomena that we practice the Dhamma. Why? Because that is, this present moment is karma unfolding. Karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by what we're holding in mind. If what we're holding in mind is the Eightfold Path, then we will give birth to a moment inclined towards awakening. Did you have a question or comment?
You just said increasing karma. What could it be, experiencing karma? Or is it, I'm just...
You mean the reference to the reaction?
Yeah.
Yes, you could say that it is continuing the experience of karma, which is another way of saying continuing the experience of suffering. But you can also say that you are increasing your, if you're not diminishing your karma,
right. All right.
the only thing that's really occurring is an increase. And we can increase karma. And I should also point out, karma is not good or bad. And it's a wrong view to look at karma as good or bad, except that it's not what we want. If we're having a karmic existence, it's because we're experiencing life from a fabricated view, a misunderstanding of Four Noble Truths. So yeah, it's an ongoing, when we're reacting to what's occurring, it's an ongoing experience of...
Feels that. almost like a increasing frequency of experiencing karma, maybe.
It's a good way of putting it, the frequency of it.
You know,
you
notice it more, perhaps, or it's... I don't want to, maybe this...
No, but I think you're, and it's important to start addressing it in that way, as a bringing the abstract definition of karma into the practical experience of five clinging aggregates of what's occurring right now because of my fabricated view of myself in relation to the world around it. It's karma.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Karma is this is really important such a beautiful teaching on karma. Karma is the field of play for wise Dhamma practitioners. This quote is from the Bhava Sutta, that those that might remember the three suttas on the website on what it means to be coming. Karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. Look at how that...
Can you say that again?
I will. And think about if we lack the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, this is a completely useless saying. It might sound nice. But within the context of dependent origination, it is such a profound teaching. Again, you could say the entire Dhamma is included here. Karma is the field. Now think about a field of flowers or a field of vegetables, nice organic vegetables that you grow. If you want to do that, you're going to pick the best seeds that you possibly can. And you're going to find the best fertilizer that you can to grow that field. Karma is the field. Consciousness is the seed, meaning what we hold in mind. Consciousness in this sense and all throughout the Buddha's Dhamma it never refers to some grand cosmic consciousness with a large C that we're all part of or striving to become a part of. When the Buddha's using the term consciousness, he's simply referring to ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Karma is the field. Consciousness, the seed. What we hold in mind is what's going to develop in our field, our karmic field. And craving is the moisture. Craving is the sustenance. It's the food for what we're going to grow. And if craving is what's motivating our karma, what are we growing? More craving and clinging.
Mm-hmm.
Craving is the moisture. The Four Noble Truths state that dukkha arises. Dukkha arises as a consequence of craving for and clinging to, you can ultimately say, fabricated views of self. Karma is the field. Consciousness is seed and craving the moisture. The Buddha continues, the consciousness of human beings rooted in ignorance and bound by craving is established in wrong view. Again, a primary fundamental teaching of the Buddha. The Eightfold Path is designed so that we can recognize and abandon wrong view, because there's no room in a human mind to hold on to wrong view and right view. There's no way that human beings can hold on to wrong view and right view. But what we can do through the Eightfold Path is recognize and abandon wrong view and develop right view. Again, you could say that's the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma, to go from wrong view to right view. Establishing wrong view, renewed becoming is produced. Again, look at the context. Karma is the field. Renewed becoming of what? More karmic experiences, fabricated experiences. Karma means action. Karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present level of mindfulness. It is from a well-concentrated mind that one is able to be mindful, to hold in mind each factor of the Eightfold Path. I usually say, when it's the Buddha's words and my words, that last was my word. Right mindfulness is my words. Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of the Eightfold Path as the framework and guidance for Dhamma practice. The Eightfold Path develops the profound ability to recognize and abandon fabricated views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Again, that's the whole Dhamma. This is the entire purpose of the Buddha's Dhamma, to recognize and abandon all fabricated views arising from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Karma is the ongoing experience of ignorance. Ending ignorance of Four Noble Truths ends the unfolding of karma. A mind rooted in ignorance is a mind distracted towards continued ignorance. The Buddha taught Shamatha Vipassana meditation for the sole purpose of deepening concentration so as to support the refined mindfulness necessary to hold in mind the Eightfold Path. Is that last sentence clear? Why we have a meditation practice for deepening concentration and nothing else? We had a great talk with someone last night about this, that they meditate often for to gain insight. And there's a whole, one of the largest forms of modern Buddhism is called the Insight Meditation Movement. It's a very broad application of insight, and in fact it's an insight that is distracted towards analyzing all phenomena, and meditation is often used in that way when insight into all phenomena is not something that the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught to gain insight into three marks of existence, very simple and very well focused, and it takes a well concentrated mind and a meditation practice that is designed to deepen concentration to do that. Any other use of meditation is fine, but if it's seen as part of our Dhamma practice, then it's not fine, then it's a distraction. And I hear from a lot of people that, well, you know, I do this and that in meditation, I like to incorporate a lot of different things, and again, people are free to do anything they want, but you can't expect to deepen concentration when you're engaging in a non-concentration practice. Visualizations, you know, all that type of stuff. It's all just a distraction from deepening concentration. You might find some benefit to it, but it's not Dhamma practice. It won't do anything for your karma. Understanding karma is recognizing and abandoning all individual contributions to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing and unsatisfactory experiences, in a word, dukkha. A well-informed analysis of karma shows that karma is an ongoing aspect of dukkha, and several significant themes of the Buddha's Dhamma, such as karma arises from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, ignorance of Four Noble Truths results in painful consequences of one's actions, karma means action, five clinging aggregates are the personal experience of dukkha driven by karma. Wrong views of self, anatta, is continued through ignorance of Four Noble Truths that is experienced as karma unfolding. So karma includes all of those things. All karma is rooted in ignorance. There is no such thing
John,
as good.
You're going like 100 miles an hour.
Thank you.
Can you just slow down? Do you think so? Just.
You know, anybody besides Lorna can say that, but I depend on Lorna to tell me to slow down. All karma is rooted in ignorance. There is no such thing as good karma. A mind conditioned towards self-identification and continued conceit is a mind clinging to five clinging aggregates, clinging to form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing thinking, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Is that better?
Mm-hmm.
You could say that's I-making.
It is. It's again, that I-making is karma. Conceit is karma. The five clinging aggregates describe the ongoing personal experience of stress and suffering arising from ignorance. I've said that a few different ways, haven't I, this morning? But that's the point. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications, and then the rest of dependent origination. Attempting to manipulate future karma is always rooted in ignorance and continued eye-making, and can only continue and prolong dukkha. Rebirth and reincarnation are also central themes of the Buddha's Dhamma and closely related to karma. The Buddha understood that fabricating a view of the birth-death cycle is cruel. He understood that doing so would only provide a strategy for continuing ignorance by establishing a self in speculative and imaginary non-physical realms. We went through a whole series of talks, particularly the six or seven talks directly on jhana, where in every one of those talks, the Buddha cautions against continuing to establish yourself in some speculative realm, whether it's a future birth, again, that's a non-speculative, it's a speculative realm, or a non-physical realm of living in the realm of the devas, or the same non-physical distraction is simply thinking too much of yourself. That's a non-physical, you're living in your imagination, aren't you? And it's rooted in a fabricated view. And yet, when we can't achieve that fabricated view, we create so much stress and suffering. It can end, it can result in someone who is full of self-loathing, but there is a measure of self-loathing in any grasping after a fabricated view of self, because it arises from, I'm not good enough right now, I need to be more. Or taking that a little bit more extreme, but not so far, that there's something broken with me and I got to fix it. That's a fabricated view, and if you're using that as your motivation for anything, you're only going to be chasing that fabricated view that there's something that needs to get fixed. Lorna.
I haven't seen that in karma myself, because I think I enjoy my karma. But you're saying what I'm doing when I'm away in a dream, my own fabricated view, is I'm actually self-loathing myself? I mean,
you got to look at the underlying motivation for any fabricated view of yourself. So if we can create a fabricated view of ourselves in relation to the world that isn't challenging to our own views, we'll be pretty comfortable in that. The problem is when that fabricated view of self is challenged in some way, whether directly or just from some inner doubt about what we're doing because of the results of that fabricated view. Again, we're using an abstract word to describe something that is completely experiential to human beings. The abstract describes the practical experience of fabricated views. And so we create, the motivation behind a fabricated view is to make me feel good, to make me fit in the world in a way that I find acceptable. And that I can continue through craving and clinging, no matter how painful it is. And again, many people aren't even aware of it. Most, 99.9999% of the people on the planet are simply unaware of this. That doesn't mean that the Buddha's teachings aren't real and effective just because you are ignorant of them.
Yeah.
And so we do those things to make ourselves feel good, or at least be acceptable, and not acceptable in the world's eyes, acceptable in our own eyes. And again, that's why we grasp at things that make us feel good, and we might incorporate it just in our life, but if we're seekers, something that has the spiritual or Buddhist label on it that in the moment might make us feel good, we'll incorporate it into our practice when it's only just another distraction. Again, we can't go by just because something makes us feel good. That works. The Buddhist taught the Satipatthana Sutta to show us the foolishness of relying only on feelings. He took that to the fourth level of consciousness or mindfulness, to be mindful of the present quality of our mind. Why? To show us that if the present quality of our mind is distracted or painful in some way, that there's something wrong with our thinking, not something wrong with the world. Mm-hmm. Unless we take it personally, then it's wrong. Jay, you had a question.
Yeah, I go along with her. I kind of like my accumulated bag of goodies, and I would certainly be the one running through your field with a gunny sack at night to collect the fruits of your metaphysical labor there. But I don't see any reason why you can't enjoy, if you're doing good works and things are going well in that respect and whatever, why shouldn't you appreciate it or enjoy that? I mean, it's, on one hand, it's I'm making, but it's okay to be happy with your performance in some aspect, or if you're doing good, you're following the Eightfold Path in your life.
And, there's the there. I don't mean to interrupt you, but there's the catch there, Jay. But go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's as I've often said, I'm very happy to bask in my material possessions and my extra chocolate cake and all that stuff, and I'm not ready to, become pure and perfect enough, but on many levels lately I've had some very good successes with helping other people.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So it's like, this is wrong to, I'm definitely trying to avoid the eye making, I'm some stuff because I help some people. It's a goal that I pursued over the course of time that I'm getting some success with.
I agree completely. Being truly helpful towards other people is wonderful. And we should enjoy that. It doesn't mean that you're practicing the Dhamma just because you're helpful and compassionate. That's just a good way of thinking in the world. If you want to develop the Dhamma and awaken as the Buddha teaches, nobody has to. And it's not right, you're not wrong if you decide you don't want to. Nobody has to do that. Again, the Buddha never taught that he was a savior or that this is salvific in any way. If you want to go from a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths to a mind that has wisdom of Four Noble Truth, you develop the Dhamma. If you don't, you don't. And it really is that simple. So I hope you're not taking from me that you must do this and you must do that, except if you want to develop the Buddha's Dhamma.
Well, I think that I am a free thinker and I'm always looking for meaning. And,
yes, Jay, I understand. I don't mean to interrupt you, and I understand where you're going. That's fine. There's nothing right or wrong about that. Everybody has a right. I don't even say it's a right. Everybody will live their life. It's not a right. Everybody will live their life the way they want to. What I was referring back, if you want to know what you want, look at what you have. And so if you want to have a fully integrated Dhamma practice, the Buddha teaches what you need to do that. And I hope I'm doing that too. So again, it's not a comment that you're doing something right or wrong. This is the Dhamma. Take it or leave it. Or you can do, Jay, what most people do today is pick and choose parts that they like, incorporate it into their own fabricated views, and say, well, this is my practice. That's great. I mean, that's just the way it is. But I think you're seeing from the Buddha's teachings that that is a choice. It's not something that we are stuck in.
Well, that's one of the benefits of coming and listening to your teachings, is to find out about this and, you know, then make a choice to say, this is for me, this is not for me.
That's exactly
it. Good things. The whole thing of, you know, cherry picking your basket of, you know, the things that you really are enjoying. I guess I'm getting a little tangled up in all this, but seeking knowledge is never wrong, I don't think. You know, whether you follow every bit of it or it suits you for the purposes that you want.
Let me respond to that, just from my own personal experience. It's a somewhat accurate statement to say that seeking knowledge is wonderful, unless you want to develop the Dhamma. Mm-hmm. For many years I developed a very in-depth knowledge of modern Buddhism. And it left me increasingly more frustrated and confused as to what a Buddha taught until I actually studied what the Buddha taught. So I think me and you are probably a lot alike. Even when we were young, we had a thirst for knowledge. I always did. I always wanted to learn things.
Right.
But just because I was learning things, the world would say that just what you just said, that all knowledge is good and pursuing knowledge is a wonderful thing. And in my case, and what I've seen from teaching this for now for many years, is pursuing knowledge that is merely just a distraction with the label of knowledge is not helpful if you want to be a Dhamma practitioner. If you want to live a life of constant acquisition, I'm always want to learn the next thing. I want to learn all about quantum mechanics and auto mechanics and veterinary work and I brain surgery, study all this stuff. That's great. But it won't bring you to an understanding of Four Noble Truths. It's not right or wrong. It's just the way people choose to live their lives. So you bring up an important point. You know, thank you. I better get through this. I'm going to go back just to one paragraph. The Buddha understood that fabricating a view of the birth-death cycle is cruel. He, in the sense that it is just another distraction, teaching people that there's some value in creating future favorable births, etc. It's just another distraction. He understood that doing so would only provide a strategy for continuing ignorance by establishing a self in speculative and imaginary non-physical realms. He avoided fabricating yet another foolish explanation of commonly held views that insist on seeing self in some way as eternal. The Buddha teaches to bring to cessation any moment rooted in ignorance, so as not to give birth to continued ignorance and continued dukkha. Is that last sentence clear? Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could you read that one more time?
Yes, that's why I asked. The Buddha teaches to bring to cessation any moment rooted in ignorance so as not to give birth to continued ignorance and continued dukkha. Thank you. It is at the point of contact between what is held in mind and what is currently arising in thought, word, and deed that a well-concentrated mind can apply the guiding principles of the Eightfold Path through wise restraint. Again, that's where the Dhamma hits the road, right here in this present moment. It is in this present moment that karma is unfolding, and it is in this present moment that the guiding framework of the Eightfold Path is applied. Karma and rebirth are simple understandings made overly complicated by confused and irrelevant wrong or ignorant views. Excuse me. In relation to karma and rebirth, the Buddha concisely teaches, I am the owner, the Buddha's words, I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, I am born of my actions. Notice how the importance of that. The Buddha's not trying to teach how human beings become born, physically born. He's talking about giving birth to what's occurring in this moment. I am in this moment born of my actions. That's the most powerful and concise teaching on rebirth. And related through my actions. In other words, we string it together. We cling these actions together, and it produces a fabricated view of self, karma. The Buddha continues, my actions will determine the fortune or misfortune in my life. It's up to us. My words, any actions motivated by ignorance of Four Noble Truths, fabricated actions, will directly impact one's experience of what is currently arising. A mind rooted in continued ignorance can only give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. This is karma. It might feel good, especially if it's familiar. We won't even recognize that something might be missing here. Or I'm just engaged in a distraction that makes me feel good. A mind whose views are framed by the Eightfold Path can give birth to a moment inclined towards becoming free of karma. This is awakening. In this way, the Buddha is not dismissing the notion of future physical birth, nor is he placing any value at all on future physical birth. He simply teaches that future lives are at best irrelevant speculation and to be mindful of what one is giving birth to in this moment. The Buddha's Dhamma and the Noble Eightfold Path provides the complete framework and continual guidance to recognize and abandon all fabricated views arising from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and so to end all karma. I changed the title of this from Tuesday because I changed the title from Skillful and Unskillful Actions, the Karma Sutta, to Acting to Awaken, because I was thinking about this for a few weeks, and actually I've used that term before, but it really is Dhamma practice to understand that we act within the framework of the Dhamma to awaken, and that's related to karma, the word karma, which means action. The Karma Sutta, it's a short one, folks. On one occasion, the Buddha addressed those gathered. Listen and pay close attention, friends, and I will teach you past and current karma, the cessation of karma, and the path of practice leading to the cessation of karma. Past karma is to be seen as the sixth sense base. The sixth sense base, there are five physical senses, and that sixth sense of consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So think about that statement. Past karma is to be seen as the sixth sense base. So we are continually interpreting our life experience through contact, through our senses, mm-hmm. through the sixth sense base. As contact occurs and our mind is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, we're perceiving what is occurring through a fabricated view. And so that fabricated view creates stress, and it's experienced right here, right now. Past karma flowing into the present moment through the sixth sense base. Is that clear?
Well, that's a hard one.
Jay, you had a question?
No, again, just to be a fuss budget about the whole thing here a little bit. How can you escape the sixth sense base? That's how we receive
great
contact
question.
With the outside world.
Framing your experience through the Eightfold Path rather than a fabricated view.
But you're still, you know, karma is continually accruing as you live, and if unless you're dead, you're going to be creating karma, good or bad.
That's
I don't go for the pop.
Jay, please let me, when you say something,
yeah.
and you get into another subject, you're
I'm
missing
sorry,
the point. No, it's okay, I'm explaining why I'm interrupting you. I'm not trying to be rude.
That's fine.
The Buddha's entire teaching is to do just what you said. I don't know if you meant that it was impossible, but karma is always unfolding, to interrupt karma. That's the whole point of the Dhamma. That's the whole point of this talk. If you don't believe that it's possible or that it's worth doing, so be it. But this is the point. Getting to what you're talking about is the whole point of the Dhamma. But the only way to experience the cessation of karma is through the Dhamma. Is that understandable? Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is it?
It's clear as a group of concepts, but it's not clearly right or clearly wrong in my mind, let's say.
It's not, because it's not right or wrong. It is just karma. The word karma is an abstract concept describing the practical experience of dukkha.
Right.
It's just a word to describe something.
And you can't stop dukkha, right? You know, dukkha.
Yes, you can. That's the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma. You can't do it unless you have the tools to do it. And so if you reject or dismiss the tools, you can't change the oil in your car unless you have the right wrench. If you dismiss the wrench, if you throw it out, or say insist that I want to use an orange for a wrench, you can't change your oil, can you? And
that's
you
right.
can you can insist all you want that this orange makes me feel good and I don't like to hold cold steel in my hand, so I am going to change my oil with this orange even though it can't work. Because it's the wrong tool, you're holding on to it because you've decided that it makes you feel good. I've clung myself to it. I'm using a silly example to make the point. So we can, just because we insist on something is true, doesn't make it true. And what the Buddha is teaching, and what I hope I'm getting through here, is that there's a way of recognizing and abandoning dukkha. There's a way of recognizing and abandoning karma. And it's through a very simple and direct eightfold path. Is that clear?
Clear, but I got to say I don't buy it.
Oh, you don't have to buy it. I'm just glad that it's clear. Because that's all, as a teacher, that's all that I want to do. So that I give you, really, if you're coming here, the only thing that I can hope to do is to present the Dhamma in a clear way so that if anybody is interested, they will develop it. If they're not, they don't. And, you know, I would say by looking at how many people are here, most people don't. And that's okay. Again, if I was concerned about using numbers to prove the Buddha's Dhamma as effective, I would be doing something completely different. I would be teaching Mahayana and Theravada and Buddhism. Or I'd start a yoga class and we'd have more people and I'd make more money. But I'm not interested in doing it. And if it gets to the point where there's only two or three people here, that's fine with me. Again, I'm making a point here too that if you get a chance, listen to next Thursday's talk. But the most important thing that the Buddha realized when he started teaching was to be authentic to his truth. I realized that too after many years that I would call wasted time involved in modern Buddhism. I realized that this is the only thing that's worth teaching. I'm not concerned, and the Buddha wasn't concerned, and the Dhamma's not concerned about anything else. It's a distraction. A very good discussion.
I'm surprised you'd say that. Many years of wasted time.
Oh, it was.
I don't agree with that.
I know, but that I can say it, can't I? Because if I wish, when I look at what's included in the Sutta Pitaka, and I said this to someone a few years ago, I wish I had come across my website and my teaching, because I would have saved myself a lot of years.
Wasted 20 years.
I wish someone had told me when I first started hanging out in Buddhist, instead of people trying to protect fabricated views and teaching false dharmas, if they said, this is what I teach, but it's not what the Buddha taught. What the Buddha taught is here. And then I would have looked here and I wouldn't have wasted literally 30 years of my life chasing after something that was rooted in a fabricated view. There's many people that think, well, you found out what it wasn't and there's some value in there.
Yeah.
But if I came here, I would have found out what it wasn't without wasting 30 years, Kevin.
It's interesting where this conversation developed from, and you know, seeking knowledge and is a thing in itself and it's discrete.
Yep.
But what the Buddha's teaching is wisdom, and wisdom in our context, or this context, using our, I mean, it's emptying oneself of ignorance.
Yep.
And that's a different thing than seeking knowledge of everything and everything. You know, it's you can't notice it with everything because
everything is a distraction.
Yeah, it's
if you're holding on to it.
Like you've said before, it's very discreet, and to hold these teachings in mind, you know, it begins with a simple practice of breathing and
yep.
Following that however long it takes, years, days, minutes, will provide the clarity and the calmness of mind to hold these things.
If that's what you want.
If it's not what you want, you'll do something else. You can meditate and think about the butterflies and think about rounds of golf and whatever you want. And that's going to happen in your meditation. But returning back to that allows us to be calm enough to understand and have that
focus.
And
as you're deepening your concentration, you're able to recognize the things that you might have been enamored with in the past, and you realize they're just distractions. And that maybe that's the difference then, from going from always grasping after knowledge of things to wisdom of four, understanding knowledge or wisdom of Four Noble Truths. It's literally a different way, a different view of the world and yourself in relation to the world. Going from a wrong view to a right view. And just using the term to make the differentiation. Holding on to fabricated views is not wrong in a moral or ethical sense. It's just wrong in a dharmic sense. It just doesn't fit. Let me continue so we can finish this. I'm just starting this again. past karma is to be seen as a sixth sense base. Karma is fabricated by intention and experienced by sense contact. And if our intention is to continue to maintain fabricated views, that is going to be our experience.
Ignorance. Maintain ignorance.
The sixth sense base is past karma, just to make the statement. Let me read this in my commentary. A mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths is constantly reacting to ordinary phenomena arising and passing away. This contact with phenomena occurs and is experienced through the six senses, five physical and one mental. A distracted mind stuck in self-referential views continually reinforces ignorance and continues confusion, deluded thinking, and stress and suffering. Karma arises from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha's words. Current karma is fabricated thoughts, words, and deeds arising and passing away. This is current karma. Again, if you want to know what you want, look at what you have. Dependent origination shows that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that establishes fabricated views and all manner of stress and suffering. Karma. The Buddha's words. Cessation of karma is the release from ignorance of Four Noble Truths and the three forms of stress and suffering of bodily, verbal, and mental fabrications. You'll remember those that were here, the Dukkha Sutta, how the Buddha describes those three forms of suffering. This is the cessation of karma. The path leading to the cessation of karma, is precisely the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. This is the Noble Eightfold Path of practice leading to the cessation of karma. What could be more clear? If we're going to be a Dhamma practitioner, the Buddha tells us what we need to do. Friends, I have now taught you past and current karma, the cessation of karma, and the Noble Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of karma. Again, in a couple of paragraphs, the Buddha described the abstract nature of karma and the practical direct experience of the path leading to the cessation of that abstract concept. Whatever any teacher, this is such an important line, and it relates a lot to what we've been talking about this morning. Whatever any teacher would do out of true sympathy and compassion for their students, I have done for you with this teaching. What a beautiful statement, isn't it? My words. An authentic Dhamma teacher knows the cruelty of teaching these false and misleading dharmas. The Buddha's words. Don't be mindless. Don't be foolish. Don't fall into regret for not developing the Dhamma. Over there are roots of trees and empty huts. Establish seclusion and practice jhana. Of course, that's just the beginning of a meditation, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. Let me just say it again. Over there are roots of trees and empty huts. Establish seclusion and practice jhana. Practice a concentration practice. This is my teaching to you. What a marvelous teaching, isn't it? Mm. Simple really and direct. It explains really karma and rebirth. Mm. There's other ones that I'll be introducing over time, but I'm going to use this on retreat too. But any questions directly on this sutta, and then we'll go around the room. We'll start with Mary. Okay. Hi, Mary. How are you?
Very good. I've been thinking about meditation and that it brings on better concentration, and to me, that leads automatically to better insight.
Yes, absolutely. That's it. That's right. I don't think I've ever heard it said better than that. And so we're not meditating to gain insight. We're meditating to gain concentration. And insight naturally flows when our minds are well integrated into the Eightfold Path.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you. I'm glad you joined us today. Lorna, good to see you. A little bit more clear?
Oh, yeah. Since Tuesday, definitely. I can now see that what karma is. It's my own personal experience of my own fabrications. It's what... What goes on in my mind. You could say that the Buddha teaches the principle that we all hold in mind, fabrications.
Yeah.
And that's the overarching understanding of the Buddha's teaching. But in this teaching, he's describing that you can see your own fabrications. And when you see your own fabrications with the umbrella understanding that we do make fabrications, that is your own karma.
Yep.
It's your personal experience, and you can see it in your meditation when you think, when your mind wanders off your breath onto a thought, that's your karma. It's your
right,
own,
yeah, right in that moment.
It's your own fabrication.
Yeah, and your own distraction.
And your own distraction. Yeah. I hadn't actually put together that we live in, that the karma is rooted in the sixth sense base. But I guess it is, because it's all about your karma or your fabrications are all about one thing or another. In my case, feeling good about myself for, and just trying to boost my own ego and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So that's often the root of my fabrication. So when you were teaching this morning, and I said, I'm going to wind myself up here, but and I said, I don't understand that it's your fabrications are rooted in not liking yourself. But I can see that it's from not accepting myself as I am that I want to build up a fabricated view to make myself feel good.
Yep.
So I am actually not accepting myself at that moment.
That's great.
As I am, just as I am. Right. So
yep.
I have learned that today. There's a bunch of other stuff in my mind which is going bing, 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 bing. I guess you could say that the whole theme of what we're teaching about is to drop your fabricated views and your own karma.
That's it's the same thing.
But I think I am doing that, because when I was
you are, Lorna.
10 years old, I had another type of karma. Different things mattered to me then.
Yeah.
When I was.
Yeah, and so you produced a different experience of karma.
So I had karma when I was 10 years old. I had a different karma when I was 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, so on. So you are dropping your karma, but you're also collecting some more as your life evolves and going on that, which actually proves impermanence.
Yeah.
Your karma is impermanent. It's just like a conveyor belt that's just like going on day, minute or moment by moment, but day by day, week by week, so on and so forth. So you're changing your karma as you go through your life, which proves that it's not, you know, it's, yeah.
And your experience of it has to do with what you're framing your view of yourself in relation to the world. And that's what you're referring to. That's always changing, isn't it?
It's always changing.
From when you're 10.
So you are actually dropping your own karma, but you're also getting some more as well, which is, so I didn't see all this before Tuesday. So I have a much better understanding of
And so
what you're teaching.
Karma is, you're seeing how and describing how karma is an aspect, it's an abstract aspect of the actual experience of three marks of existence.
Yes.
And specifically, in what you just said, the impermanence of it.
Mm.
But just because karma is impermanent doesn't mean that it will come to cessation on its own.
No.
We're constantly reinforcing. We're constantly reinforcing our fabricated view of ourselves in relation to the world, and so we're constantly establishing karma and reestablishing it. But that's what the sutta is about. So, and again, you could say that the reason why the Buddha taught an eightfold path is to interrupt the unfolding, the constant unfolding of karma. Because it allows us to start changing our view and experiencing what's occurring in the present moment from right view rather than wrong view, meaning a confused and conflicted view. So that's really great insight.
Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin.
Thank you very much, John.
You gotta call you Mr. Oakmont.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that talk. And
thank
very
you.
Timely, so thank you.
Yeah. Great t-shirt, too. Yeah. John, good to see you.
Good
long.
See you. This talk and the comments that everybody has made helped me see I've gained an insight, I would say. I don't even know if I can put it into words, but I've gained an insight about anatta.
Would you try to explain it? Because it sounds
I'm just taking my time. My experience of anatta. And how I'm clinging to, I feel a strong, just right now, like this strong sense of clinging to the idea of bettering myself, and how that is that incredibly resistant to that idea of letting go of you know, projecting myself into the future and envisioning a better Jen, right? And how I like wanna like I see the urge to fight that. I'm seeing that in me. Like, and to look for challenge. You know, how I can find that's not true. And so that has been really helpful, because I see that all as, like, you know,
that's tremendous
nonsense.
Well,
my own nonsense.
Yes.
Well, it is nonsense to recognize it as such.
Right.
But the important thing, and it relates to what Jay was talking about too.
Yeah.
You said that you're looking to better yourself. Well, why would, and again, we can really start, well, why shouldn't we better ourselves?
Right.
We should.
Yeah.
But when we're holding this constant view that I need to better myself,
yes,
the underlying view
yeah.
is that there's something lacking.
There's something wrong.
And that is the distraction, the constant distraction that arises from a fabricated view. And people will say, well, don't we need that motivation?
Sure.
How would you live your life without that?
Yeah.
The most, just look at the Buddha's life and those around him that awaken. They lived the most meaningful and purposeful and impactful life of anyone. And as we all start developing the Dhamma, I think we'd all say that our lives become more meaningful, even if it's not fully developed yet. Because we're letting go of, in this moment, that very subtle need that what's occurring right now needs to be improving me,
right,
or making me better or greater. What is that? That's called conceit.
Yeah, you don't need to convince me. I know.
Oh, I'm not trying.
I know you're right. I know. I see it. But what I'm saying is, I've been able to recognize that this sense I have of wanting to challenge that is just that, because that arose within me, and because I have the Dhamma practice, I've been able to say, oh, that's not, or that's anatta. And even though I have no, I can't really even put it into words. I can only just say, okay, I know that's an insight. A space.
Yeah, you're talking about.
To recognize that's what I need to abandon, kind of thing.
That's what this article refers to. That's what wisdom of restraint refers to in this moment. To be able to recognize and abandon fabrications arising. Understand and recognize and abandon karma arising directly. It's not, again, it's not some.
Really want to, I like want to fight. Like, I want to fight it.
Yeah.
Definitely want to like fight something.
That's, yeah. And that's all an aspect of karma and a mind rooted in ignorance that's clinging to, that's where the word applies to, clinging to those wrong views. Even though we, on some level we might know that they are wrong views. We don't want to let go of them because they're familiar.
Mm-hmm.
They're what we've used to define ourselves, not to the world so much, but to ourselves. We decided, this is the kind of person I am. no matter, we don't realize that those are fabricated views, and because that's who we think we are, we justify our behavior from that fabricated view.
And all of my thought processes.
Yeah.
I mean, not all, but like, I'm not a big generalization, but yeah.
And in the end, we live another human life. It may be incredibly successful, like Jay was talking. It might be, and it might be a Nelson Mandela life. You know, who could argue with a life lived like that? An incredible man. I mean, we can think of a whole long list of wonderful people as examples of that. Yet they didn't use the opportunity in this life, they weren't aware of it, to awaken. So you can't say that Nelson Mandela was bad or something. He certainly wasn't,
right,
was he?
Right. Mm-hmm.
He just didn't develop the Dhamma. And again, maybe he was aware of it, maybe he wasn't. If he was aware of it, then he made a choice not to. But that's not right or wrong either.
But yeah, even if you're saying to yourself, I need to be better or I need to be worse, it doesn't matter what you're saying. Mm-hmm. It's still a judgment.
Yeah. It's still a judgment.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Aren't you supposed to follow the Eightfold Path? Isn't that one of the central things? You're supposed to be a better person if you can be. And to follow these things which are good, how could it be bad for her to want to improve herself?
Another important question, Jay, because it's what we're doing to improve ourselves.
Yeah.
In other words, I could have a view that
I'm
the most that I have a big date coming up next Friday night. So the most important thing to me between now and then is to get a new shirt so I look good for that date, rather than put my efforts towards developing the Dhamma. I had an interesting talk with someone who has, and this has come up a few times, that they spend a lot of time in meditation, but not much time doing anything else. And so they're wondering why their views are becoming even more confused than they used to be. Well, because you're not doing anything to change it. It sounds good and it feels good. And a lot of your friends might be doing the same thing. Wonderful, go ahead. But you're not going to develop concentration. You're not going to develop the right framework. It's all wonderful. But when you incorporate the Eightfold Path in a real Dhamma practice, then you can gain insight into that and see it. If you didn't, 4 years ago, what you just said would have been complete nonsense, wouldn't it? And now it's one of the most meaningful things to you.
Right, right.
Because it's a real experience that you're having. And you're noticing the results of that. It's not, we also feel, one of the problems with living a fabricated life is we understand on a, usually a subconscious level, less than apparent level, maybe I should say, or less than mindful level, that it is fabricated and it's tenuous and it has no real foundation. There's nothing really there. It's like when we went off the gold standard, I won't get into that talk. There's nothing really supporting my fabricated view except my own view. But the Dhamma establishes ourselves with a foundation in reality. It gives us a reference point to live our lives. And that's what you're describing, what we're all describing. So, wonderful.
I think it's admirable.
Yeah, I think it is too. Lisa, good to see you this morning.
Good
how are
to
you?
See you too, John. Fine. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, my mind's a jumble. but I did, last night I did read that up to the end of what Buddha said. It seems that the concept of karma and dukkha has some overlap because you could almost substitute one word for the other in a lot of instances.
Yep.
And so that's even more confusing for me. And I often don't understand a lot of, I mean, very often you say, is that clear? And I would just say, well, yeah, clear as mud.
Well, let me explain that one. The dukkha and karma really are the same thing. Karma is the abstract word used to describe the ongoing unfolding of dukkha, but the reason why the word is important is the reference in this sutta that this is the way that you end the constant unfolding of karma or the constant unfolding of dukkha. Dukkha arises from ignorance. As the Buddha teaches, ending ignorance ends karma, so it ends dukkha. One's the abstract, one's the actual experience, the visceral experience of it. And you could say the same thing about the five clinging aggregates, which is the ongoing personal experience of dukkha. So it's a little bit more of a refined teaching on the same subject. And as I said a few times here, karma is the central theme of the Dhamma, not some anachronism that should be just ignored. If we attend to our karma with the intention of ending it, we're Dhamma practitioners. If we don't, that's okay too. Does that help?
Yeah. Good. Also related to what's been brought up, and this goes way back, and I'm not sure it's something you said, someone said, or I thought, but also way back, I went to a meditation, and then someone I know brought a friend, and then later she said, well, I didn't like that. I don't know how to empty my mind and not think about anything. And by that time, I kind of had already been involved in it, and I don't know how I responded. I probably didn't say anything. But you know the thing where people are afraid that if they let all this go, there won't be any of themselves left. So you have a person, and then you have this empty space. Well, what is it? The nature doesn't like a vacuum or something, like whatever. But you know, it's wonderful to get it filled up with these ideas and these ways of living your life. So you empty the garbage and you bring in, you know, teachings and good things to think about and things that are helpful in your life. But the thing that just didn't ring true, you said about I wasted all that time or 30 years or something. And then you said about Nelson Mandela, how 30 years or something, or 20 years he was in jail, right?
I think it was
South
closer
Africa,
to 30 years.
Or something like that, but that's kind of just an aside. But don't people say, well, if I hadn't gone through all that, I never really would have understood such and such, or I never would have done this in my life.
Yeah, my experience is a perfect example of how fabrications don't bring that, because all I was studying was fabrications. There was no benefit to it, except, I mean, I would say in some way that, and you hear me the way I teach, is I have a direct, kind of like the Buddha, you know, and the Buddha teaches his own awakening story, how he studied with different teachers and found that it wasn't helpful.
Right.
And so he then spent a lot of his Dhamma teaching saying, this is my Dhamma, but it's not that. And he taught that from direct experience. So I can do that.
But what I
said was that I wish someone had come along and said, this teaching is not what the Buddha taught. That is, look at that. Because I would have saved myself a lot of wasted time chasing something that was just fabricated. And to me, I would have had just as much knowledge of what the Buddha taught if somebody just said, it's this and it's not that. And I would still be able to teach in that same way, because I would have had the experience.
You had to find that out yourself. So you found that out yourself by going through all that. Nobody came to you and said, you know,
yeah, but,
this is no good. This, you know, this
but,
is
yeah,
no
but,
good.
But if someone had come to me and said, and I was very good friends with some very famous Buddhist teachers. You know, and when I want to learn something, like Jay says, I'm not shy about finding someone and calling them directly and going and seeing them and sitting down and saying, I want you to tell me what this means, etc. And I did that with a few of them. And so they were wonderful people. I'm thinking about one in particular. He was one of the funniest, warmest men I've ever met. We used to go out to lunch at times, and we'd go eating hot dogs. You know, he had an obsession for hot dogs. And cigarettes, which
makes
me
think of that Buddhist hot dog joke that I just heard this morning.
What was it?
That's a great old joke.
What did the Buddhist monks say to the hot dog?
We'll have one with everything.
That's right.
Make me one with
everything.
Of course, that's not really what the Buddha would say, would it?
Right.
So I want a very specific hot dog.
Exactly.
To be one without ignorance.
So the reason why I say that, and I can understand, the kind of the concept that while everything I've learned has been valuable because it got me to this point, at that point, where I was no place that was of any value to me as far as developing understanding. So I spent, and maybe 30 years was a little bit too long, I'm trying to think when I 26, really it was more like 20 years now when I think about it, kind of wandering around. If someone had just told me, go to becoming-buddha.com and study what's there, then I would not have spent all that time literally wasting time and money learning something that I know now is simply fabricated. It's not based in reality. So what good is it?
But John, it makes you so much more authentic because you know about all that.
I would have been just as authentic if someone had said, all this teaching over here is not what the Buddha taught. Study the suttas. And I would still have the same perspective.
That makes you capable of all those people who come.
Lisa, let me say it this way. Because I had such a wonderful experience in that 20 years of listening to fabricated views, I might as well instill that, give you the opportunity to have 20 years of fabricated Dharma practice by teaching nonsense. I mean, I'm not putting you down personally, but that's kind of what you're saying. Because I found it valuable. Well, listen, today's class is going to be on chanting. So let's learn how to chant, and I would advise that you use this chant every day. And then next week, we're going to learn about how many times we can bow in an hour. And that's a very good practice to use. So let's learn how to bow, and we'll do that forever and ever. Then the week after that, let's learn about visualizing deities to intervene on our behalf. I could do all that. I learned all those things. I'd probably be good at teaching that. And it would be the cruelest thing I could imagine doing. Why? Because it would be wasting your time and giving you further reason to maintain fabricated views of self. So that's why I say it was a waste of time, because it would be a waste of time if I continued it, wouldn't it? I think.
Well, you suffered through that, literally suffered, because you said some of it was really, you know, you were depriving yourself of food and, you know, and sitting for hours at a time. So you actually did suffer, on our behalf, so we don't have to.
Well, I hope so, but I will tell you that even during the times that I was suffering, in my mind, I felt like, this is pretty good. This is right. Really wonderful. Look what I'm doing. I just spent 10 days in silent meditation for 14 hours a day. Wow, that's great. I'm on the edge of awakening. And all it was 10 days of intense distraction. In fact, even people that were honest at the end of it said, the best thing I got out of this 10 days is that it's over. And that's my experience. A lot of people would say they had a great experience in that 10 days. They wouldn't say that. To me,
what if they're in the fabricated views?
Well,
it's nothing like sitting on a cushion with no distractions and letting your mind go. I mean, that's a good experience. That's the good experience that they would have from it. But
yeah, I hear people talk about how wonderful the silent retreats are, you know, and whatever, how many it's 2 days, 3 days, 5 days, or a week. Mm. It is, because for most people, being in silence is a fabricated way of not having to face yourself.
Yeah.
And the Dhamma is just the opposite. That's why I don't lead silent retreats.
It's much more challenging.
Say an observation. This is what I'm seeing. So sometimes when I hear you say that you're being hard on yourself. So that's
saying what?
Saying when you say that you have kind of this wasted period of time in your life. And maybe that's not what you're saying, but I think that's sometimes what I hear, and that makes me want to be like, be gentle with yourself, you know, so.
Thank you. I'm not saying it that I regret it, though. I don't approve of that time that I wasted. I accept it because it's what I did.
Right, okay.
And you're right, I am glad that for some reason, I still don't know why I thought that this is nonsense. The Buddha wouldn't teach something like, oh, an awakened human being wouldn't teach this. How can I find it? Because that was the thought that led me to start, is there a way to find out exactly what the Buddha taught? And what I found out was, yes, there is. And when I found that out, I also found out that it's something completely different than I was taught at all. It wasn't like, you know, they were missing the point a little bit. The contrast between what a Buddha actually taught and what has developed is significant and rooted in ignorance, from my own experience through all that. No.
Well, the funny thing about that is that that led you that Jay, when he reads about people, he reads what they wrote themselves. He doesn't want to read about what people are writing about that person. So he tries to go back to primary writers of what that person wrote, whether it's our founding father, anyone. So when you said that, it was like the similarity.
Yeah. Well, and that's what happened when I started reading the sutras. I was reading, but even then, I can't translate from Pali or Sanskrit. I also can't translate from German, which a lot of the early texts were translated first into written German. I don't understand any other language but English. So I rely on other people's translations. But even then, when I read them, when I started developing, there was an aha moment for me. When the suttas aren't presented as start here and read, you know, they're not presented in a chronological, as a chronological study, what you should, you know. But when I finally understood and read the Paticca-Samuppada Sutta, dependent origination, the way it was presented, because everything I heard about dependent origination had nothing at all to do with what the Buddha taught. And then I read about the Four Noble Truths, and I read the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Then I had the context for applying what the Buddha taught, and it started to make sense. And I started, and because of that, and that's why I say that if we're going to understand the Buddha's Dhamma, we have to understand dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, or we can't apply it properly. That was the beginning of the end of my own fabricated views of what a so-called spiritual practice should be about. And so that's why I teach what I teach.
Right. Well, many clergy will go, like, if they really want to, you know, translations of the Bible depended on what the translation was depended on who was writing it. And there were political motivations, social motivations, and religious motivations.
Yeah.
That nothing. So a lot of clergy will learn the original language that the Bible, you know, whatever it was, the Bible, let's say, or just different writings, was written in Greek or Hebrew or Arabic, and then try to learn it really, really well, become a scholar, because they don't want it filtered through how somebody was translating it and what their motivations were.
Well, that's an important point. And
so that's what you're, I mean, that's very, very similar.
Well, and what I found, too, when I started reading the translated suttas, that even the translators, and this is easily understood, anybody just understands just translations and period, they're impacted by the person's view. And so I rely on probably 5 or 6 different teachers, primarily, not translators. And then even more specific would be Thanissara Bhikkhu and Bhikkhu Bodhi and Maurice Walsh and Sister Kama. But even then, once I understood the context of what the Buddha taught, I can see where their influences from their form of Buddhism has altered their translations. In other words, the Pali and Sanskrit aren't languages that have almost no one-to-one correlation from word to word. So you're really translating and abstract thoughts, even though they're real words that are on paper. So unless you understand the context, your translation is not going to have much fidelity to what you're translating. So even though I'm using, for example, Thanissara Bhikkhu's translation of the Karma Sutta, I think this came from Thanissara, I'm changing it in a way, and I say it, that so that it has relevance, it removes as much repetition as possible, but again, it maintains relevance and contextual accuracy to dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, because that was the Buddha's intention behind what he was teaching. But if you don't understand that, or in the case of, let me say this carefully, because it is going to be out there. In the case of some teachers, they can't help but interpret their translation based on their beliefs of what Buddhism is all about. So some people will weigh their translations heavily towards what's in the Abhidhamma. Others like, I mentioned his name, Bhikkhu Bodhi, who really feels a need to make all Buddhism one and treat it that way, that it's all kind of one teaching. So he translates it in that way. When I read it and I write it, you know, I don't, by the way, I don't just copy and paste these suttas. I write every word and I translate it into my way of seeing things in relation to how the Buddha taught. And again, that changes
you said
everything.
That in your book, I mean, in your books too, you'll say that this is exactly what you just said there, that you're making it relevant to your goal.
Yeah, I'm writing and doing a series of Thursday night talks on the Dhammapada. I think that'll be my next book this summer. It's a 26-chapter book, but I'm referencing on each chapter at least six different translations of the Dhammapada. And it's remarkable how some of them are so contrastingly different that you'd wonder where they're getting this information from. But I also understand what the Buddha was teaching and the context, and that's what my, I don't know if you can call it translation, going from one English phrase to mine, but reinterpretation, I don't know what you might call it, but that's what it is. And so you can't, what I realized too was that unless you interpret the Dhamma in the proper context, it just leads to all kinds of speculation. So it's important. And that's why I emphasize it. Keep it on this.
That's fascinating. I've been to Bible studies and we'll have all different versions of Bibles. And, you know, the different, you know, Methodist and it's this translation and that translation and, you know, different religions. And they're very different. So in itself, it's an interesting study of comparing translations.
Oh yeah, the one of the world's foremost professors of comparative religion, specifically comparative Eastern religions, happens to be a cousin of mine. We don't talk about it. His name is Carl Olson, and his books are, I mean, he's really brilliant. So they're a little bit difficult to read, but they are fascinating. And his description of the different paths of mind, in fact, one of his books is the different paths of Buddhism and how they came to be. The interesting thing about my wonderful cousin is he's never meditated once in his life. He has this incredible depth of knowledge of all schools of Buddhism, but it's only scholarly. And I mean, he's a great guy and all those things, but that's what he wanted, so that's what he got out of Buddhist practice. No real insight. Again, he doesn't have to. He's a good guy. Great class. Jay, good to see you.
Thank you, John. I got to apologize if I offended you by objecting or giving a different viewpoint of the viewpoint you were presenting. But
not at all.
You know, my dear old granny used to say, the validity of reasoning is governed by increased dialectical refinement. The best answers are the ones that you chew on for a while. And the more you chew on something, the better answer you get. Yeah. That's, you know, so...
Yeah, no, I don't, you inspired a great conversation today, great class.
I hope so. I meant to be productive and positive and not be negative, but, you know, the end is you do want the truth of these things. And thanks for, we got the wisdom, it took you 30 years of eating pineapples out there and meditating in Hawaii in 15 minutes on a rainy morning.
There you go. That's right. And you bring up such a good point. Really what you talked about this morning is what we're going to talk a little bit more about next week in hindrances. It's what prevents people from wholehearted engagement with the Dhamma. Because we don't want to give up these other things that we've developed in life. And that's not right. Excuse me. That's not right or wrong. It just is. It's just the way it is. And again, that's how the Buddha presented. This is what it is. Take it or leave it. You know? If you want this, you do this. So, and that's all part of karma too. So great class. Mary's left us. We'll finish with metta as we always do. Is there anything? I feel like I'm missing something.
Retreat's coming up.
Retreat's coming up a week from Thursday. Come. if you can. It really is a marvelous time. A few new suttas this year. But we'll finish with metta as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.